Welcome to the Joseph Campbell Audio Collection. This talk is called The Arthurian Tradition. It is the third talk in the series entitled Western Quest. And now, Joseph Campbell.
The period of the Arthurian romances, the high period of the Arthurian romances, is exactly that of the building of the cathedrals. It's the wonderful, wonderful century from 1150 to 1250 AD. This, in my view, is the counterpart for later Europe, let's say Europe of the Gothic times, the counterpart of the Homeric period for the earlier Europe. We have two great Europes, the Europe of Greece and Rome, and the Europe of the Celts and Germans. And the stress on the individual not as the subject of the state, but a citizen of the state being a vehicle of his will, this is European. And already in the Greek understanding of what happened at Marathon and Thermopylae and so forth, you have the appreciation of themselves as very different from the whole Orient. There was enormous respect for the Egyptians, for Egypt, but they were Orient. And in the Orient, you don't have individuals. You have people of certain types, certain memberships, certain races, certain strata of society. We're beginning to get it back. I say the Orient's overtaking us again. But there have been moments in European history, this little peninsula of consciousness in the field of the great Eurasian-African world mass, where the individual has stood forth. The throwing of the responsibility off on dharma and what Yeats called the primary mask, what is put on you by the society, relieves you of personal responsibility. This is the attitude of the soldier. A good soldier is not responsible for what he does, he is responsible for how well he does it. And that's the attitude of Oriental life. When a draft comes along and a Western individual becomes a soldier, very often he has a terrific psychological crisis to face because he has to move into another order of virtue. And it's the order of the earlier sort of humanity where there are no individuals but only agents of an impersonal order. And then no one's responsible for the order either, because that comes down from ancestors, so no one's responsible for anything. And you have an absolutely cold-blooded situation. I remember in India one time in Bombay, I asked a gentleman on the street the way to the post office, and he pointed it out to me, and I said, "Thank you very much." He said, "Oh, it's just my duty," and walked on. I thought, holy God, get a human response to a little question like that. Well, this Oriental religion, namely Christianity, with all of mankind inheriting Adam's sin and all of mankind possibly saved by Jesus' deed, with no individual doing anything on his own, the sin wasn't yours in the first place, nor was the salvation, this is brought into Europe. It's brought into Europe with real force. The end of the 4th century, you weren't allowed to think anything else. And then, a couple of years later, of course, the whole Roman Empire collapses. And let's say the European Roman Empire collapses. And what we call Rome from then on is really Constantinople, which is Byzantium, which is Asia again. So this totally alien point of view is put on Europe. Europe had perfectly good religions and mythologies going fine, and then this other thing is brought in on top of it. And what you get then in the creative life in Europe is an attempt on the part of the European mind to assimilate this and translate it into something like European thinking. And in my view, the great moment of that achievement is the moment represented in the Arthurian romances. You have a Christian vocabulary, but completely European form of consciousness. However, in the later 13th century, after the establishment of the Inquisition, we hear no more, or very, very little more, of new creative productions in the spirit of the Arthurian romances. There are rewritings of them, translations of them, and so forth, the most important for the English-speaking world being Malory's Morte d'Arthur. But there's no more important creativity after about the date 1230. Now, the backgrounds of this European consciousness are very, very deep. There has been a recent correction of the carbon 14 datings for Europe. Do you know about this? It was found that on the basis of tree rings, a realization was rendered that the carbon transformation, however this darn thing works, is not the same every year. So there is a tree ring correction that's been made in the European datings, C14, which has pushed some of the datings back very, very far, so that the emergence of civilized consciousness in Europe in the period of the Great Goddess is now being dated something like 7,000 BC. That figure of the pig goddess that I showed is from 5 or 6,000 BC. This is very, very early. The development of the agricultural life in Europe is early as anything in the Near East. And then we have in Eastern Europe this very important development. There may even have been a kind of linear writing, linear script invented. There are a couple of signs of this, in which case it would have been 3,000 years earlier than the Sumerian finding. And then westward of that, in Western Europe, you have the emergence of the great megalithic system, Stonehenge and Woodhenge and Newgrange in Ireland, and the megaliths all over the Carnac area in Brittany, and down to Spain. It's a tremendous development and may go back as far as to 4000 BC. That's earlier than the pyramids by far. Pyramids were under the fourth dynasty, the third actually, the Step Pyramid, 2600 BC. The importance then of this antiquity of Europe and a long, long past must be recognized, and it's the past chiefly of the goddess. So that the basic mythologies of the European consciousness are those of the goddess, even pre-Bronze Age, from almost pre-ceramic Neolithic, and then the later Bronze Age. In Cornwall, there were tin mines. In Ireland, there was gold floating free in the River Liffey so that you could pan for gold. Wherever there was tin in the Bronze Age, there would be an important exploiting colony because tin was an important ingredient of bronze, and it is not found in very, very many places. And so from an early time, that Irish Sea area, Dublin and Wales and Cornwall, the Isle of Man and Western Scotland, was a kind of matrix of civilized living. This is the background of the Celtic mythologies, and is the background also of the prominence and power of the goddess figure in these mythologies. Our fairy godmothers, for instance, are reflexes of all that. Then it's in about the first millennium B.C., let's say about from about 1000 B.C., that we begin to have coming into this realm of the British Isles and Western France, the Celts. Now, the Celts are Indo-European people. The Indo-Europeans have their beginning in the southwest Russian steppe lands, north of the Black Sea. They're called now the Kurgan people, Kurgan being a Russian name for the mound burial. And these mound burials, which are the mound burials of warrior chieftains, there are the characteristic symptoms of the extent and period of the Indo-European early diffusions. They're diffusing, or they're extending from in two directions from that area, one southeastward and the other southwestward. Southeastward, they go into India as the Indo-Europeans, the Vedic people, with the warrior chieftains and their cattle herds. These are the people who had mastered the horse and became thereby almost invincible. I mean, the horse and the war chariot were the counterparts of the atom bomb today. You just can't do anything about it. They override and overrun and take charge. At the same time, this chariot goes all the way into China. And the first Chinese dynasty, the Shang Dynasty, 1523, you have the chariot. So there's a big continuity across the whole of the Asian world of this horse culture and chariot culture. Before that time, with the separation of peoples, everyone was going on foot. And peoples would go apart and become very closely linked into the landscape of their new land. Now, with this emergence of the horse, we begin to have a big intercourse back and forth, almost like the thing that's happening now with the airplane. You know, people who formerly had been separated from each other suddenly come into relationships to each other. So we see big cross references. And as a result, I would say, the sometimes startling parallels between what we find in the Celtic world and the Chinese world, they really are not too surprising, because there is a back and forth relationship. Well, of the various Indo-European peoples and groups moving out of these centers into new centers, one of the most important for the West was the Celtic community. And the area of its constellation is Southeast Europe, in the area of Bavaria and Austria. At that place and time, 1000 BC, they are called the Hallstatt culture, H-A-L-S-T-A-T-T, the Hallstatt culture. They're rather heavy wagons with, like the wagons that went across the plains here, when was it? About a century ago. When they get into Western France, a new brilliance comes into the culture, and this brilliance and period is known as the Latène, L-A, and then capital T-E-N-E with a grave accent over the E, over the first E. The Latène culture. Real brilliant chariot warriors, glorious gold work and metallurgy, with clean, very graceful designs. It's really a group of ruthless barbarians, but glorious metal artists. And it was a group of these people who, in various waves, move into the British Isles and over into Ireland. Now, this earlier Bronze Age group in the British Isles were, as I say, mother right people, matrilateral in their descent so forth. Uncle is the governor, actually, of the mother's son, and so forth. The Celts, however, are patriarchs, patriarchal, and vigorously so. As you move from the barbarian to the, let's say, British and then Irish areas, the force of the patriarchal accent becomes less and less emphatic, and the continuation of the female accent more and more perceptible. So that by the time you get to Ireland and Wales, the mother goddesses are still the most powerful. And the typical story that one finds in the legendary dating from those periods is this: of a patriarchal, young patriarchal warrior type who is led astray by following some animal or something of the kind, and he comes to a fairy hill, a hill into which the old mother goddess people have retreated with the arrival of the patriarch. And the queen of the fairy hill becomes his mistress. When he arrives there, he finds the queen in distress. There are the people of another fairy hill that are harassing her. And he becomes her champion and stays with her. Now, as in Wagner's Tannhäuser, he may, and the Venus Mountain of Wagner, he may stay there for a long, long time, and it may seem to him to be only a year or so. And then a sort of nostalgia for his old-time home will come over him, and he will ask the goddess, or the fairy queen, permission to visit home again. And she will say, well, yes, but be careful not to touch the earth. And when he comes riding back, nobody knows who he is. The country is completely different from anything he had known before. Something like hundreds of years will have passed. And let's say he drops his sword or drops his helmet or something or other, and he stoops over to pick it up, touches the earth, and just disappears. He has been dead for 100 years and now it's confirmed. Well, this becomes a major motif in the later Arthurian themes, and we'll see it time and time again, of the hero who befriends and defends the chatelaine, the lady of a besieged castle, and becomes her consort and so forth and so on. And you can see from that old Celtic Bronze Age coming together of the male powers and the female, this theme announced, which comes rolling down right through the ages. Well, when you start going into the entering of Neolithic people into Europe, you get into a pretty complicated thing. There are the urn burial people, and there are the bell urn people, and one kind after another. The identification of these different peoples who came into Europe and over into the British Isles is extremely complicated. There were almost certainly very important Mediterranean continuities connected with that old tin trade. Irish gold and Irish bronze are distributed all through Europe. In the Hellenistic period, you know that figure of the dying Gaul, this naked Gallic warrior, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, wearing a torque. The torque is a kind of necklace with two big heavy heads meeting. He's wearing an Irish torque down there in Turkey. The trade was really very strong between those islands and the mainland. And whatever the peoples were, I don't think they've been identified really at all. There have been attempts to identify different waves with the waves in the Irish mythological cycles, which tell of one arrival after another, but those are very obscure. They're the kind of people that would have been on the mainland as well. What their specific restricted racial affinities are, I don't think we really know. There have been always, between Spain and Ireland, connections by sea. And there were sea connections. Caesar, when he gets into Gaul, remarks the seacoast people that have a trade running up and down the coast, and was this trade in gold, trade in tin, trade in bronze, and so forth. Now, so we have the Celts. The Celts, the center for the Celts, you see, moves up westward of the center of the Germanic people. The Germans are another group of Indo-Europeans, but their center is somewhat eastward of the Celtic, eastward and northward. They're people of the same sort, and their language is closely related. The Celtic languages and the Germanic are varieties of the Indo-European complex. So we've got two levels I'm talking about now. One is the Neolithic Bronze Age people with a metrolateral accent. The next are these people from the Black Sea, and then with a stopover in southern Europe, the Celts, patrilineal. And these Celts come in this century, the millennium BC, from 1000 to, let's say, about 50 BC. Next, all of Gaul is divided in three parts. Caesar's Gallic Wars, the Romans conquer France, and by shortly after Julius Caesar's time, they conquered Britain. The Roman conquest of Britain, you can date it in your mind, roughly 50 BC, and it lasts roughly until 450 AD, so there are 500 years of Roman occupation of what we now call England, then was Britain. The Roman occupation reached up to what we now call Scotland, and westward almost into Wales. That left Scotland, Wales, Cornwall, the Isle of Man, and Ireland as unconquered territory outside of the Roman conquest, but subject to Roman influences. Meanwhile, the Germans are piling up eastward. Meanwhile, also, Persia on the east. Now, the extent of the Roman Empire is almost impossible to credit. It's enormous. The whole of North Africa, Europe, to the very borders of Persia. And there were Roman roads right across Persia. And there was a Roman trading station on the border of China. We have a text called the Pericles of the Eritrean Sea, which is the log book of a Greek mariner sailing Roman ships in the Indian Ocean. His principal trade route was from Egypt through the Red Sea, down the whole coast of Africa to Mozambique, and westward and eastward, South Arabia to India. There was a Roman trading station south of Madras on the east coast of India at a place called Arikamedu of 50 BC. And Roman coins have been found in Vietnam and in the Philippines. It's almost incredible, the power and really majesty of the empire of those people. Now, this whole empire becomes Christian in the 4th century A.D. with Theodosius the first and second. The dates are 378 to 395 for Theodosius the first. Christianity is declared to be the only permitted religion. Persecutions begin, as I've said time and time again. But for us, the important thing is the missionization in that early period of the British Isles. The British Isles become Christian. And with the story of Patrick, Ireland becomes Christian in the 5th century. Now, one of the paradoxical calamities of Christianity was that after Rome had been Christianized, it fell. The whole point, really, of St. Augustine's city of God is, yes, the city of man has fallen, but the city of God has triumphed. Well, that was small comfort. The fact was that the place collapsed. The Christians were actually comparable, I would say, to the communists in our part of the world today. They were eating it out from inside, what the Chinese call the maggots. And not only that, but the Germans were pressing down from the north. And this pressure became emphatic when Attila the Hun comes smashing in from the east, and one German tribe after another was pushed westward and just in terror, you might almost say, broke down through the Roman Empire. With that, in the 5th century, the Romans have to shorten their lines. And the whole Roman defense line up the Danube to Britain is pulled back. They pull their troops out of England. That leaves England, after 500 years of Roman occupation, like an oyster with the shell taken off. And what begins to happen? The Celts the Picts from the north, there were no Celts there at that time, the Picts from the north begin pushing down, the Celts from the west begin pushing in, and the Germans from Jutland come into England. There's a long story here of the collapse of British rule in what then became England. But it is that moment, the collapse of the Roman Empire, the invasions up and down the line by the Germanic tribes, the inadequate defenses of the Celtic people, particularly of Britain, that is the background of the Arthurian legend. described in the old chronicles, the chronicles of Gildas and Nennius, of his times, shortly after, of the 6th and 8th centuries, as a dux bellorum, a leader in war. And what is now pictured by the scholars of this subject is a sort of Roman-trained military man who helped the kings of southern Britain in their battle against the invading Germans, that is to say, against the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes from what is now Denmark. The southern part of Britain was the field of the collisions. The chronicles tell of 12 great battles in which Arthur, Dux Bellorum, this Roman-trained military man, like, say, some Senegalese officer trained by the French, was assisting the kings of the south. And at the last of the battles, Arthur is killed, and the German triumph is confirmed. During the course of this invasion, there were, of course, refugees, particularly from southwest England, who went to what is now called Brittany in France. The whole Britain Peninsula is populated by people who were refugees from Britain. And there grew up in their world what is called the hope of the Bretons, the hope that Arthur would return and restore to them their homeland in the south of England. So, we have as the historical moment underlying the image of Arthur, this period in the late 5th and early 6th centuries, let's say from about 450 to 650 to 550 or something like that, of these invasions. Then we have a period of oral legendary reciting the deeds of this great deedsman and the building up of the hope of the Breton legend, namely, of Arthur as one who will return to restore their world to them. It's out here in this country, it's a little bit like the hope that inspired the ghost dance religion at the end of the last century in America. That the ghost dancers would dance and dance and dance, and that another land would come over the land that the white people had taken, and only the Indians would be able to jump up onto that land, and the buffalo would be there, and the old world would be there again. This is the kind of thing that that is a common motif in the traditions of defeated peoples. Now, where is Arthur meanwhile? There are three principal interpretations of where Arthur is residing. One is that he is under a burial mound, sleeping in the hill, you might say. This is a motif that we get throughout the world, too. The sleeping giant, the sleeping savior in the tomb, in the great burial mound. Another view is that he's residing in the lower half of the world, in the Antipodes, among the pygmies and dwarfs of those of the South Pole, or something like that. But the most charming and the most popular was the story of him sleeping in the island of the West, Avalon. Now, Avalon is a Celtic formation of the word apple. Apple and apple, the P goes back, becomes a V, apple. Avalon is the land of the golden apples. the counterpart of the classical Greek Hesperides. An eternal land, a timeless land, like the timeless world of the sleeping giant in the hill. It really is the world of the unconscious. It's the world beyond time and space. The world of the Sambhogakaya, of the mythological forms that endure beyond time and yet are not the void. It's between the realm of the void and the realm of phenomenality, the realm really of dream and vision. That's where he sleeps. And that realm was in the past and is in the present and is to come. It's all around us, like the silence around Om. Here's this body, then, of oral mythology. Now, it does not break into writing, into scriptorial statement, until 1136. On that date, there is published a work by a monk, Geoffrey of Monmouth, The History of the Kings of Britain. This book purports to be a history of the kings ruling in the British Isles, specifically in Britain, from the time of the fall of Troy until the coming of the Germans. The model for the book is Virgil's Aeneid. The story in Virgil's Aeneid is of the fall of Troy, the escape of Aeneas, a Trojan, from Troy, his voyages until he arrives in Italy, and his establishment of Rome. The same model is used for the coming of a figure named Brut, B-R-U-T, after whom Britain is named, from Troy, the length of the Mediterranean, up and around to Britain, and establishing there the line of the British kings. The book is a compendium of Celtic lore, which up to that time had not been known to the literary world. And it broke like a bomb on the world of the time. Immediately, it was translated into Norman French by an author named Wace, W-A-C-E. And it's in Wace's version, the work is called Wace's Brut, B-R-U-T. It's in Wace's version that the Round Table first appears. This is immediately later, still 12th century. Right after that, there's published in Middle English, a book by a clergyman in the south of England named Layamon, L-A-Y-A-M-O-N, a work called Brut. Enormously popular. And when you read Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, which can be obtained in translation in every man's library, there you find Shakespeare's Lear, King Lear, with his three daughters, and you find at the end the story of Vortigern, the last of the British kings who actually invited Hengist and Horsa into Britain to defend him against the Picts and the Celts. And you find the story, the beginning story of Arthur, the legend of Arthur as it then had developed. So that's my little prelude to what I'm going to call the whole history of Arthur. In England, it is King Arthur that was the most important figure of these cycles. When the material was brought by bards to the courts in France, Arthur was not so important. France already had its hero king, namely Charlemagne. What became important were the knights of the Round Table and their various careers. So that in the English version, the original English versions, we have the story of Arthur as most important, whereas when we get to the continent, it's going to be the French. What had happened in England previously to the writing of the History of the Kings of Britain was an event of importance no less great than that of the invasion by the Germans. And this was William the Conqueror's conquest of the last of the English kings, 1066, at the Battle of Hastings, when King Harold was overcome, and the Norman-French dynasties of England were established. Look what we've got here. We've got the early Bronze Age Motherite people. We've got the Celts, the patriarchal Celts. We've got the Roman Empire. We've got the invasion of the Germans. And we've got the invasion of the Norman French. If we take the last three groups, what we see is this. Here are the Celts at the bottom. Here are the Anglo-Saxons on top of them. Here are the Normans on top of the Anglo-Saxons. Now, just as in our colleges, the sophomores persecute the freshmen, so the Anglo-Saxons had persecuted the Celts. But then they move up a notch, and you find what were the freshmen persecuting the new freshmen, and the juniors in spiritual alliance with the freshmen against the sophomores. Do you get me? That was the situation in England. You have the Celts at the bottom, you have the Anglo-Saxons here, and you have the Normans. Well, the Normans had conquered the Anglo-Saxons, not the Celts. And they put the Anglo-Saxons out in the yard, taking care of the pigs. Whereas at the table where the pig's flesh was being eaten, people were speaking French, not that vulgar English. So when the food is outside, it's a pig or it's a swine, and when it's on the table, it's veal, it's bull. When it's outside, it's a sheep, and when it's on the table, it's, what is it? Anyhow, I got the wrong one. When it's outside, it's a cow or a calf. When it's on the table, it's boeuf, it's beef. French, indoors. English, out there in the pantry and in the servants' quarters. Well, we have to have entertainment at our meals, and the favorite entertainers were the Celtic bards. The bards of the Celts, entertaining in the Norman courts. It's a lovely history. So we got two new things running. One, Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, written for a Norman king, namely Henry II. Henry II's empire included France. And it was to have a mythological background, just as Rome had had. And this History of the Kings of Britain, now it seems very clear, was composed actually with the patronage of the House of Henry. Henry's wife was glorious Eleanor of Aquitaine. Dates 1122 to 1209. She is it. She's the whole romantic period that we're talking about. She had come from southwest France, Eleanor of Aquitaine. Her first husband, to whom she had been married when she was a little girl, was the King of France, whom she despised. Apparently she went with him on a crusade to the Holy Lands, And there was a scandal that became published, you might say, of her having an affair with Saladin, the Muslim monarch. But she couldn't have had an affair with Saladin because he at that time was a little boy of about 3 years old. But that's how the story's going around. Anyhow, when she came back, she managed to get loose from Louis and just went up to England and married the other king, King Henry II. So she's the wife of two kings. She's the mother of at least three. She's the mother of Richard the Lionhearted and the mother of King John. She's the mother also of Marie de Champagne, and Blanche of Castile, I think, is also her daughter. At any rate, three generations later, she was the ancestress of every royal head in Europe. Her father, her grandfather, William of Poitiers, was the first of the troubadours. Now, the troubadour tradition was comes from the southwest of France and is strongly influenced by poetic traditions from across the Pyrenees, the Moorish poets of love. And you see what a complicated thing this is. Here, now we have the Moorish stories of love and poetry of love of the troubadours, which shortly later period, the end of the 12th century, moves over into Germany with the Minnesänger. Minne is love, medieval word for love, the singers of love. And there's that tradition. There are the Celtic bards in the Norman courts, which include also Avignon, which include also Aquitaine. And these Celtic bards are telling the old Celtic stories in 12th century costume. That is to say, the gods and heroes of the old Celtic tales are parading in their stories in the costumes of medieval knighthood. And these are the Knights of the Round Table. Now, I think I presented it fairly clearly, this terribly complicated situation. The background motifs go back to the old Celtic invasions. The cultural layers are those that I've described. The romance comes from the Celtic world into the Norman world by way of these bards, Welsh bards, Cornish bards, and bards of Brittany. And they're the old Celtic stories turned to the new ideas. With that, let me now go into the stories. The whole history of Arthur, as it occurs in Geoffrey of Monmouth. Behind Arthur is this wonderful figure, Merlin. Geoffrey of Monmouth wrote another work, a shorter work, called the Vita Merlini, the Life of Merlin. And in that life, the figure of the Druid, the Celtic magical priest, the counterpart of the Indian Brahmin, the Brahmin as the magician of the Kshatriya or warrior, so also Merlin as the magician and mystic master of the warrior princes. The life of Merlin is modeled on the image of the Druid priest, but with certain specific characters of the Arthur's time involved. Particularly a man named Ambrosius, who seems to have been largely responsible for overthrowing Vortigern, who was the traitor to England, so forth and so on. The story of Merlin is, briefly, of a boy whose mother had conceived him of a devil. Of course, in the Christian tradition, whenever you have a miracle that's not the miracle of God, it's the miracle of a devil. And the devils are simply the earlier deities. So you have the old story of a virgin birth. Merlin could appear either as a boy or as an old wise man. He, as a little boy, uttered a prophecy to King Vortigern, the last of the British kings, that his empire was going to collapse. And he described it in the way of an allegory. You are trying to build a tower, and he was trying to build a tower, but the tower won't stand firm because in the ground underneath are two contending dragons, a white and a red dragon. Well, these are the two races that are contending. And Merlin brought it about later that Vortigern should be defeated. Then his next work was to produce the king who would now govern the happy new world. This was going to be Arthur, the beginning of Arthur. He was to be from the house of a certain queen, Igraine. His father was to be Uther Pendragon, who was not Igraine's husband. Merlin arranged that Uther Pendragon should assume the form of Igraine's husband, and while the husband was away, have intercourse with her, she thinking it was her husband. Thus Arthur is begotten in extramarital magic. Merlin, next, has this whole theme of the sword in the stone. The sword is the sword of destiny. One of the great important powers recognized in early times was that of the smith to draw steel from a stone. And it is this steel of the sword that represents the virtue and triumph of whatever people were talking about. So there's this legend of the stone with the sword in it that could be drawn only by the one to whom it was destined. Merlin produces Arthur, who draws the sword. So there's the beginning of a whole context of imperial story and development. Guinevere becomes the wife of Arthur. The king of Rome, the emperor of Rome, sends a challenge to Arthur to submit to the king of Rome. Arthur arranges an expedition to go against Rome. And while Arthur is on expedition against Rome, his nephew, Mordred, seduces Guinevere and attempts to take over the throne. Before conquering Rome, therefore, Arthur is called back, gives battle to Mordred. Mordred is killed, Arthur mortally wounded, and carried off to Avalon. That's the whole history of Arthur. You see there the germ of what comes up later in the Lancelot story with Mordred. Only Lancelot is an honorable man and simply caught in this invincible passion, and which Arthur recognizes as something even more, well, I'm going ahead of the story, even more important and sacred than marriage itself. In this earlier view, Guinevere is cursed, Guinevere is downgraded, and the female does not have the celebration and value that she has in the later stories. So much for the story of Arthur. That's as it comes up in the History of the Kings of Britain, in Wasse's Brute, and in Lehmann. Now the stories go to the continent. There are certain bards whose names we know. There's one named Bleheris, And there's another saint named Kiot, to whom the stories have been attributed. In medieval story writing, there is not free invention. There is what is called the matter, and there is what is called the sense. The poet takes the matter and interprets it in his sense. So the matter of the Arthurian romances was brought to the French courts by the Celtic bards, transmuted from Celtic story, and then picked up by writers and turned into a literary form. To summarize very briefly again, the period of Arthur in the 5th and 6th and 7th centuries, the early chronicles telling of his life, the oral tradition of the Hope of the Kings of Britain, the writing of Geoffrey of Monmouth of the History of the Kings of Britain, then the coming of bards, Celtic bards, to the French court, celebrating old Celtic tales as though they were knightly tales, linking the knights of their tales to the court of Arthur, and these tales then finally, at the end of the 12th century, being turned into French and German. The German Tristan and Parsifal are the great works of the Middle Ages. They're the top ones. Gottfried of Strasbourg's Tristan, Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parsifal. And it's of those two that I want to speak this afternoon. The Tristan of Gottfried and the Parsifal of Wolfram. And they will take up our whole afternoon.
You have been listening to The Arthurian Tradition, the third talk in the series entitled Western Quest. This recording was authorized by the Joseph Campbell Foundation and produced by Electronic Educational Programs. Our theme music is by Acoustic Alchemy. For more information on the Joseph Campbell Foundation, please call the Foundation at 1-800-330-MYTH. That's 1-800-330-MYTH. Or you can contact us on the World Wide Web at jcf.org. I'm Maura Vaughan. Thank you for listening.